Good morning. This is Sally Krigbaum, and it is June the 12th, 2018, and I am visiting with Lynn Potter in her home. So, Lynn, you were born where and when? And
I was born in Springfield, Illinois. Haven't come too far, but Springfield was a wonderful place to grow up. It's a special city. Not just because of Lincoln, I guess, and the history, and it's the capital of the state, so I always felt like I was immersed kind of in history in Springfield. So I was there until I left for college, and at that point, I never really went back, except I usually had relatives there, so I could go visit, and still, it felt like home.
Okay. Well, tell me about your parents. What were their names, and what were they like, and what did they do?
Well, their names. my dad came from a good German family, and his name was Hubert Ernst, not Ernest, but Ernst Helmley. And my mother came from the South, and she she moved to Springfield when she was in high school, and I guess took a lot of criticism about her accent, and they just called her Alabama. But
okay. And, well, tell me more about Springfield and what it was like. And you went all through school there?
Sure. I went to Butler Grade School, and we lived about six blocks away from school, and I played the cello, so I always had to carry my cello to grade school. And then I went to Springfield High School, and that was about 2 miles away. And often I had to walk with my cello the 2 miles. but I still enjoyed the cello. And my family, my great uncle was an architect in Springfield. And he built probably half of Springfield. Springfield High School, where I went to school, St. John's Hospital, Methodist Church downtown, which is no longer there. many, many homes, Governor Yates' home in the west end of Springfield, hundreds of houses. So I always wanted to be an architect. However, I was very lucky to get through geometry in high school, so that kind of squelched that ambition.
And was this your father's brother or your mother's?
No, this was on my father's side.
Okay. Right. So his name was Helmley?
Uh-huh. Yep. And so.
And do you have siblings?
No. I was an only child. And spoiled? No, certainly not. Even though I was only child, only grandchild. I didn't feel spoiled. I felt like I had to obey my parents, and was I obedient? Yes. Was I mischievous? Let's say adventuresome. And I had a very interesting childhood. I was always outside from a young child right on through. Get up in the morning, you go outside and play, and you played with the neighborhood kids, no matter what their ages were. I mean, you roller skated, you rode bikes, you played tag. We put on plays in the vacant lots. Anything your imagination could come up with, we did. And my childhood was certainly very, very happy.
So. And what did your parents do for a living?
My mother stayed home till I was probably in the fifth grade. And after that, first she worked in a drugstore that my father worked in. During the Depression, he worked in a drugstore. And then after the drugstore, my mother dispensed glasses for an ophthalmologist. And my dad was a mechanical engineer for Alice Chalmers. We would go to the state fair every year. And as you walk through the gates, at that point, all of the farm equipment and tractors were on your right. So we had to go there first and visit the tractors. And of course, I had no interest in the tractors, but he examined them all, and then we were able to go to Happy Hollow and do the rides, and then the horses, and then the butter cow. So State Fair was always big in the summer. In fact, that was my first job. I was a waitress at a food court in the fairgrounds when I was in high school. I guess I was about 16 when I started there.
Okay. And earlier you said you were lucky to find geometry. Is that right? And why?
I was horrible at math. If I had been good at math, I would be an architect today, because I've always loved that profession and what they've done, and I love old buildings and new buildings. And but no, math was not my thing.
Okay, so why did you choose Millikan University, and what expectations did you have?
Well, when I came here, I did so because of their music school. As I say, I played the piano and the cello, and I was going to be something great in music. And I don't really know why, when I was standing in line waiting to sign up for my first semester, I looked at some of the students that were in the music school, and I thought, I don't have that much in common with them, which is a stupid thing. I don't know why, but I decided, no, I'm going to go just a regular path. And so I majored in world history, because I've always been a history buff. And I had a minor in English and in French. And thought I would major in French maybe, but then decided that I went to a high school class that was part of my assignment from some French class. So I went to a high school French class, and I couldn't understand what they were saying. So I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't major in French, but I'm happy to have had a minor. When we were overseas, I was able to tell the difference between cheese and butter, and that helped a lot.
Oh, dear. But why Millikan? Were there colleges in Springfield that you could have gone to, or did you...
Well, I
did you have people, friends at Millikan?
I had a boyfriend that went to Millikan.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did. And so that probably, between that and the music school, that's probably why I chose Millikan.
Okay. And was that Dwayne, your husband?
No.
No, someone else.
Yes. And but that only lasted a year while I was at Millikan. Then my second year, I had a blind date, and that was my husband of 64 years.
Oh, and how long did you stay at... Well, you did eventually graduate from Millikan, but you didn't stay...
No,
the whole four years.
Dropped out after the first half of my junior year, because I was pregnant and I just couldn't see... going to school and being pregnant. That was a silly decision again. I could have Paul wasn't born until June 24th, and I could have made it easily, but I didn't think I could. So I still had a year and a half to finish. And when my last child went to school, my fifth child went to school, I went back to Milken and finished my year and a half, and then taught school, taught English and world history.
So after you were married, did you and Dwayne live in the barracks?
No, we lived in a basement apartment of Albert Taylor's old home on the corner of Wood and Fairview, which is now, the home has been torn down now.
Oh.
But that was his old home, and it had been turned into apartments. And we had a basement apartment. We'd look out our window and see feet going by, and always thought, well, there's no place to go but up. So, and then he went to work for Illinois Power after he graduated on time, and then he went to work for Illinois Power. And they kept moving him all over. We lived in Hillsboro, Gillespie, Aledo, Decatur, Bloomington, Champaign, Decatur. They just kept moving him around, which in a way was good. It meant promotions every time we moved. But as I say, I learned to clean house simply by moving from one house to another. I've never counted all the houses that we lived in. So. But it was fun. My kids, somebody asked me one time what school one of my children went to when they were such and such an age. I said, I have no idea. because we moved so much and five kids, I couldn't keep up. They always went to school, they did well, but it was usually a different school that they went to every year.
Mm-hmm. So did they mind all the moving around, or did they kind of like it?
They took it in stride. I remember we built a home in the home park area, and we're just moving into it, and there was still a little bit of construction around the outside of it, and my 4-year-old was going around the house picking up nails that were in the yard, and I said, why are you picking those up? You don't have to do that. He said, oh, these are for our next house. Oh. So, you know, as I say, they just kind of knew it was coming and took it in stride. So.
Okay, you have alluded to your five children. Would you care to name them?
Well, I think I can do that.
Okay.
I have Paul, who is my oldest.
Who was a dentist.
Who was a dentist here
in Decatur.
And is
now retired.
And is now retired. In fact, that was my last job. After I had retired several times, I went to work as an office manager for Paul. And when he retired, I had no choice but to retire myself. So,
okay.
And then there's Karen. And Karen has two children, and she is a business analyst at ADM. My family knows computers, I don't. Then there's Julia, who has, she got her nursing degree from Ball State in Indiana, and Karen got her degree from U of I in Springfield. Julie was a nurse for maybe 6-7 years and decided she wanted to do something else. So she went to work for Siemens and became a sales manager for computer systems in the hospitals. And I don't know what she did, but it was it was fine. And then I have Stephen, who lives in Phoenix, Arizona, and he's in charge of Gamage, which is a Kirkland at Arizona State. It's their big facility that was built by Frank Lloyd Wright, and he books all of the shows they have there and works at that facility. Tom's been all over. He went to Florida and gained a wife from Florida, and then came back to Augusta, Georgia, and managed a furniture store for us. At present time, he is here in Decatur and is working for Crown Toyota, selling cars there. And that's five.
And he and his wife have adopted?
That's my granddaughter. I have 11 grandchildren, and one of my grand Tom's daughter adopted a little girl. Who is now 4 years old, and that's been a wonderful thing for the whole family. So, yeah, two great grandchildren. So,
okay,
yeah,
yeah. So, talk a little bit about what you have done.
What I have done. Okay,
you've been very active. Always busy.
I am always busy. Not always. You're either overwhelmed with things to do or you have nothing to do. When you have nothing to do, you keep taking on jobs until you go back to having too much to do. So, right now, I'm kind of at a happy medium. I always been interested in historic preservation, so when we came back to Decatur over 30 years ago, decided that we bought a home on Melican Place and had to restore it. Actually, it was in bad shape. And we decided that we're going to make this neighborhood into a great historic neighborhood. That was my goal, I guess. And I worked hard at it. We had a neighborhood group called NRAPS, and I worked partly through them, partly just on my own. I visited other cities and presented a big proposal for landlord licensing to the city. It failed by one vote when it finally came up, but still it got their attention and the city was helping us. I got rid of many drug dealers in the area. I found that if you stood in front of a car and wrote down somebody's license plate while they were inside buying drugs, that they never came back again.
Oh.
And so we worked at that, got rid of the drugs. Little by little, we did improve this area to now. Actually, this is a wonderful area. We got a designation of historic district from the city of Decatur, which didn't give us a lot of money, but it did give us some prestige and some attention.
Are you talking about Milken Place or larger
area? No, our historic district is pretty wide here. As a matter of fact, it's on the National Register of Historic Places. It's about it goes from Fairview to Church Street to maybe Decatur to North Street. I mean, it's a big, big area.
Okay.
And I worked on the Historic and Architectural Sites Commission for the city, and that was one thing that we did, was try to regulate a little bit how people redid their houses in this district. We weren't always popular, but it did help with the general appearance of the district. And I worked at the Melican Homestead, helped with the renovation there, was on the board, was president of the board for a couple years. And then...
About what time was that?
In the early, it was in the 70s sometime.
Okay.
I don't know the exact year, but yeah, it was in the 70s. And then we went, then I went over to Governor Oglesby and started working on that house. Actually, I worked there from the inception of it. When the Conservation Department got the house, they loaned it to Governor Oglesby Mansion Incorporated for a dollar a year. So that was the organization that actually put the house together. And I scrubbed floors. They had an old stove in there. And I remember I had kind of soot and dirt all over my face from cleaning out that stove. And Lindley Hurt, I don't know, came in.
He was an attorney, right?
Yeah, yes. And he looked at me and he said, "Get out of there and don't you do that again." But yeah, we worked hard at it and we were successful. Martha Montgomery helped me. Well, I helped Martha, actually. She was the big cheese. She knew a lot more than I did, and we were the ones that purchased things for the house and the wallpaper and decorated and stuff. And so I worked hard and long for Oglesby. 7 years I did their newsletter. I worked, I say, long time at Oglesby. They kicked me out last year. 2 years ago, I guess it was.
But the Oglesby Mansion has turned into a really gorgeous place.
It
and
is.
Many, many people worked to make it that way. You and...
Oh, yes, you, yes.
But you were one of the main ones. And
well, not necessarily, but I worked hard at it, so... yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... you've been involved in historic preservation, and haven't you and Duane personally purchased some homes and lived in them and restored them?
Right. I think I counted one time 30 homes that Duane and I have been involved with. And they weren't all historic homes, but they were all homes that in the historic area that needed help. And mm-hmm. And then I partnered with two other gals, and we had a company, Architectural Restorations, and we worked at historic homes, basically redoing them and trying to get rid of apartments that were in them and turn them back to single family. And I think we did about 20 homes altogether. And we got involved with one on West Main Street, and we loved the house, and we did restore it. It was beautiful, but we were kind of upside down as far as our financial affairs were concerned after we finished that house. So we decided to commercialize that and try to get some of our money back on it. So we opened a tea room circa 1860, and everybody loved it but us. we were losing a considerable amount of money every month, so we finally figured out after 4 years that it wasn't going to help us much, and we had to sell it. But it is now a single family residence, and the very nice. So.
Good. Yeah. So tell me about other jobs or activities that you've been involved in.
Well, the Culver House is one that I'm involved with right now.
And that's where?
That's on the corner of Prairie and Edward Street. And
the northwest corner?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Directionally challenged, but you're right. It's northwest corner. And so I'm working on that now. And actually, through the years, we've done a lot of retail. I had a bicycle shop, and my dentist's son was the one mechanic for us, and he was very good at bicycles, too.
I don't remember a bicycle shop.
Okay, it's where the Dean Cunningham Center is right now on Church, and right behind the Salvation Army.
Oh,
we were on Church Street.
All right.
It was an old building there.
And place that in relation to other things that you have done, that time-wise.
It was when my son was in college, so the end of the 70s.
Okay.
And we sold an American bike, an American Aero, and we sold Peugeots, and very nice. And enjoyed that.
And how long did you keep the bicycle shop?
Probably 3 or 4 years. We lost our mechanic. He went to Chicago to dental school. And it just kind of faded out. But, and we've also owned Post Jewelers, which I operated. That's my favorite job. I really, really enjoyed that. I love crystal china, silver, anything of that sort. So I was right at home. And jewelry.
How did you come to buy posts?
Well, there was a newspaper article written about us at the time, and it said, to get a diamond, buy a jewelry store. We could not afford an engagement ring for me when we were married, so I really didn't have a diamond. I just had a plain gold wedding band. And so I thought, I would like a diamond ring.
Yes.
So, I don't know. They were going out of business. The posts were deceased, and the store was closing. And we just thought it was a good opportunity to buy. And I loved retail, so we bought. And enjoyed it thoroughly. Dwayne was still working for Illinois Power, so I was the manager. And he chimed in once in a while. Don't do that. I said, he sees black, I see white. But we did fine. And we thought the Hickory Point Mall was going in at the time. And we estimated it was going to take maybe 10 to 15% of our business away from us. But we were wrong. It took more than that. Plus, Case Merchandise Mart started discounting some of our good brands, Lennox and Waterford and so on, and we were still about service. And so we could have changed the store and made it successful, but I didn't want to change the store. I liked what we had and what we were doing, so we sold that. But I really did enjoy that.
Yeah, so Post was a Decatur institution.
Yes, it was.
And it was sad to see it go. What year did you sell it? Do you remember?
1981, maybe? 1981? Okay. Something like that. Close.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then we moved to Augusta, Georgia, and we had...
Did the power company send you to Augusta?
No. Dwayne, at that point, was working for Merrill Lynch, a stockbroker.
Okay.
And he could go practically any place he wanted, so we took a tour and drove all around the South trying to find where we would like to go. And decided on Augusta, so he went to work for Merrill Lynch in Augusta. And I don't think he really liked what he was doing. Merrill Lynch would tell him to sell this particular stock because it made them money.
And
he was more apt to tell the guy, don't buy this because it's not going to work. So anyway, we bought a furniture store, opened a furniture store down in Augusta, and then opened a second one. And so our Tom ran one store, and I ran the other. And Dwayne oversaw both of them, kind of. So, and that was good. That was good. That lasted until our con man became active. Our con man was... was just that, a really, really adroit con man. He was stealing from us very badly. He was the kind, he could look you straight in the eye and you believed he had nothing to do with anything. Mm. And I remember he sold tickets to the Masters in Augusta, mm-hmm. sold them in California, and people were supposed to have a plane ride and tickets to the thing, and of course none of that ever materialized.
Oh, so, dear.
Yeah, he was very active. But anyway, we really decided at that point we had 6 grandchildren back in Decatur, Illinois, and decided we were strangers, and so we just sold the stores and came back here. So, and that's when I went to work for my son as a office manager.
So. Okay, and that's when you got involved in NRAPs and historic preservation?
Right. We came back in 89, and that's just when this area needed the help the most, so I was happy to step in and try and do what I could to help restore this area. And we moved back in 89, December, I can't remember, it was right before Christmas, and it was 80 degrees when we left Augusta. When we got to Decatur, Illinois, it was minus 24.
Oh.
And we thought we had made kind of a mistake coming back here. But no, Decatur is home. I think Decatur's poised to do great things right now. So I'm very optimistic.
Good. So eventually you moved to this house on the corner of Edward and Decatur. The right. southeast corner.
Right.
And
when we came back from Augusta, we moved to a house that was about a half a block away from our Melican Place home on Prairie. It was an old 1870 Victorian house.
And
you and Dwayne were doing
a lot of the work yourselves,
yes,
right?
Yes. In fact, we took every inch of paint off the outside of that house with a heat gun and repainted. And that's been 20-some years ago, and I drive by, and the paint job is still good, so it makes me very happy.
Yeah, and how long did it take you to restore that house? It was a big deal.
Yeah, 4 or 5 years. And then we moved to 531 West William because it needed help, and I thought I could live in that one too. So we sold the one on Prairie, moved to the one on William. You have to understand these houses were in bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
They needed tender loving care. And the one on William we restored, and that was probably right. I remember standing on the steps across the street at the church, the Christian Science Church. Banging pans when the century was upon us, and I think we moved in there in 99, then the call, like an old fire horse, when you hear the bell, you gotta go, and this house was for sale, and it was needing help a lot. It had been duplexed, so we turned it back.
You're talking about this present house?
Yeah, the present house we're in had been duplexed, and so we turned it back to a single family, and it took us a year. There were 75 windows in this house, and every single one of them needed caulking and repair, which my husband did. That's not me. I worked on the inside. The two of us are now sitting in this 5,500 square foot house and enjoying it. We use it all, but it is for sale now because our children have downsized. We figured it was almost time for us to downsize. And we do have a cottage out of Southside, so we would be happy out there if we sold this one.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the history of this house.
This was built by the Holt family. which Mrs. Holt was a Scruggs, and she was part of the Linen Scruggs family with the department store.
And didn't they also have, the family had Scruggs, Vandervoort, and Barney and St. Louis?
Uh-huh. Yes. That's the family she came from.
Okay.
So, and then they opened Lynn and Scruggs here, mm-hmm. and Mr. Holt became part of that. The pier mirror in my living room came from the Scruggs home in St. Louis.
Oh.
Yeah. One of our friends, of course, lived in this house because it was duplexed for his family. His family moved in with Grandma and Grandpa, and that's when they duplexed it.
And that was the Rudys.
And that was Rich Rudy, right, the Rudys.
Mm-hmm.
And, right. So yeah, every house we've been in has a history.
Has a story to
has
tell.
Has a story to tell, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So, and you have been telling stories about several of a couple of houses.
Well, yes.
You've become a writer, and how did that all happen?
Well, for 46 years, I've been saying I want to write a book. I had a story, and as my writing club tells me, I am a storyteller, not necessarily a writer, but a storyteller. And so for 46 years, I've been wanting to tell the story of these letters I found in our attic at number 3 Milliken Place. And
how did you find the letters?
Well, actually Duane found them on the third floor. The third floor was never turned into a ballroom at Milliken Place. It had the space and it was a finished room, but you wouldn't call it a ballroom because they had their central vac system up there and some other things. But on the side of the room were enclosed attic spaces, had little doors. And after we lived in the house for a year, my husband decided we gotta do something about these heat bills. They were atrocious. So he said, we'll insulate those little attic spaces up there. And so the insulators came, and Duane wanted to go up and check and make sure they'd done a good job. So he opened this one little door, and there was a protruding chimney there, and just barely behind that chimney he could see a bump and that the insulation had left, and that just didn't look right, so he kind of crawled over there, and this bump turned out to be a box, so he drug it out in the room, and it was a 2-foot by 2-foot box wrapped tightly in a 1919 newspaper.
Oh.
And he thought he found his fortune. So he didn't say anything to me. He took the box down to our bedroom and locked the door. When you have 5 kids, you have to have privacy. So he locked the door and took the box, unwrapped it. And soon became very disappointed. He expected gold coins or stocks or something in there. And became very disappointed as he determined they were just letters and mementos. So it was just the Grady's old mementos, he thought. So at that point, he came downstairs and told me he found a box. And I came upstairs and we started examining the letters and realized that these were love letters. And pretty soon we could realize that they were not from Mr. Grady. They were from someone else.
To Mrs. Grady.
To Mrs. Grady. And so we were very proper people, so we decided they should be burned. So I went down to the kitchen, Duane went elsewhere, and I took it for about an hour and then decided I had to go see what those letters were. Ran back up to the bedroom, and what did I find there? My husband, sitting on the floor, reading the letters. But anyway, then I started researching, and it took a lot of research to determine who the letters had come from. And so I had this wonderful story. It's took place between 1915 and 1919, a four-year affair, but it was just full of history. And the man that had written the letters turned out to be a very prominent man from New York, and it was just a fascinating thing. So, finally, when I was let go from my job, I didn't have anything else to do, really.
You mean so, when your son retired?
Yeah, when he retired.
Closed his dental practice.
That's right. And so I started writing and wrote the book, The Forgotten Life of Sarah Grady. And actually, it's been very successful. And but I'm just happy that people have enjoyed the story.
Yeah. So why was it hard to determine who the man was? Didn't he sign the letters?
It just in Morse code. He signed Ed in Morse. Half of the letters were in Morse code, and there were 450 letters.
Oh my goodness!
So it took me a long time to decipher the letters. I had to use the cheat sheet for the Morse code, Sarah Grady had gone to great lengths to keep his identity a secret. So sometimes he did sign them Ed occasionally in Morse code, but he also signed them Hieronymus, and I've never figured where that came from. First I thought it was the Mueller family.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But no, that's not the case. And sometimes he just would sign it as a pet name or something. And but she only made one mistake, or I never would have known who it was. In one of the letters was this little newspaper clipping from a New York newspaper, and it had the picture of four businessmen in there. And one of those businessmen was identified as Ed Rockefeller. And I figured, hey, Ed, that's got to be him. And so I went on that trail and found him. So,
but you did a lot of research.
A lot of research, yeah. That's right.
Verifying that they had been certain places at certain times.
Right.
How did you do that?
The letters, even though it was one-sided, I had none of her letters, but he would refer to things she had said, things she had done. So I had quite a bit of her ideas and things that she had done. I had one primary source. Mrs. J.T. Whitley was still around when I found these in 1970. And Mr. Whitley had been Sarah Grady's attorney. Mm-hmm. And he was deceased. And of course, Sarah disappeared in 1921. So this was all way back in the past. So she talked to me very freely about what she knew about Sarah Grady. I found that she knew some things, but she didn't know about Ed.
Oh.
She knew Sarah had had an affair, but she didn't know. It was not with Ed that she thought. I don't know. So newspapers, and the letters. There were 450 letters, so I had quite a bit of information. And, the internet, that you just dig.
there.
And I enjoyed every minute of it, really. And,
okay, so now you're on to a new project.
Yeah, now we're writing a book about the Culver House. And so...
Are you doing it on your own?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It's basically the history. The title of my book is My Plot of Ground, The History and Legends of the Culver House. So it's basically a history, but there's some paranormal things that have gone on in the house, and so that's why I say history and legends of the Culver House. So I've interviewed a lot of people, and again, newspapers are a great source. We'll see how that turns out.
So are you almost through with it?
I'm done with the first draft. And now I've got one of my writer's club people is probably going to edit it for me. So, and this I intend to be a fundraiser for Culver. So I'll give it to the Wabash Depot, Kim Alcamp to sell, and hopefully a lot of people will buy it, and the money will be donated for the renovation project at Clover House.
So, well, the renovation has been going on for a few years, hasn't it? And what's happening?
Yeah, I do laugh. Sometimes I cry, but Historic Decatur Foundation was established in 1998, and we chose as our first project the Culver House. And we've never gone beyond the first project because the first project is still an ongoing project. And anything that could possibly go wrong, the Peter Principle was in full operation at Culver House. And but we've done a lot of things. We got a new roof on the house. The house had a fire in 79, burned the roof off. And when you say burn the roof off, you're talking about skylights, gables, all kinds of things. This house is an architectural gem. And the lady that owned the house at the time just put some tar paper on the roof and really did not finish it. She took off for Wisconsin, and then the house starts its deterioration. Mm-hmm. And it's been quite a we have new blood right now on our board, and we're soaring at this point. So how long this will last, I don't know, but I'm hopeful.
So what do you mean when you say you're soaring?
Well, we've got two new members on our board, Greg Sullivan and Bruce Nims, and they've brought a lot of new enthusiasm and ideas and so on. And we're in the middle of a capital campaign now. And Bruce is handling it, and he's doing a wonderful job. So I'm hopeful that right now it's just money. That's all we need.
Historic Decatur Foundations, that was you and who else?
There were 18 of us when we started. We met at your church, actually, the First Press, and there were 18 of us, and we were going to pick out historic structures in Decatur that needed help and try to revitalize them. And that's why I say we started with Culver House and have never gone beyond that. And year by year, little by little, people dropped out just because we weren't getting anywhere. Well, we were getting somewhere, but not fast enough. And it finally came down to four of us. And we four have stuck with it all. We couldn't get control of the house. Someone bought it at auction for $1,600, which was unbelievable. And we tried to buy it from him at a good profit, but he was not in the mood to deal with us at all. In fact, he took us to court about seven or eight times, and that's a whole book in itself. But we eventually got receivership for it, which meant that we could, that he was out of the house, we could go in the house, do whatever we wanted, and then if he paid us for our work, he could get the house back. But of course we were doing $150,000 for the roof and so on, so he couldn't come up with the money to do that. And so we were able in 2004, I think it was, took us to get control of the house. And then we were able to start in. I won a prize once. Caterpillar had this inspirational event. Imagine something, where they brought business leaders and community leaders in to be inspired by this man from Oregon, who was very good. It was a two-day seminar thing, but at one point they asked who had the most, I forget how they phrased it. Anyway, they gave me a prize for being the most optimistic person because I was working on a house that I didn't own, that I needed about $300,000 to. And I said, then we're going to do this. And I won a prize for being so optimistic.
Was it monetary?
No.
Oh, too bad.
No. But it was fun. So, yeah. So, yeah, I enjoy writing, so I'll probably continue that. And I will continue to try to help this historic district. I have the vision of people sitting on their front porches like they used to, and people walking by, and people being friendly, and so on. It'll never come out to be exactly that, but it's moving along, and it's a wonderful place to live in the urban area of Decatur. So
yeah. So back to the book. How does one get a book published?
I self-published.
What does that mean?
That means Amazon has a company called Create Space, and I sent them my copy that was edited, and they were the ones that formatted it and published it for me. And it was fairly expensive, but it was a good deal. And now I have print on demand with them. So if I want one book, I can have it. If I want 500 books, I can have it. They sell it for me on Barnes & Noble and Kindle and e-books. So, but then I started the second book, and that company dropped its... one of the divisions that would have allowed me just to send it to them and have them do it. So now what you have to do to deal with them is format it yourself, which I am attempting. My computer and I do not always see eye to eye, and so I have gotten the grandchildren involved several times. And I lost six chapters of my book while I was writing it.
Oh, how awful!
Yes, I cried. That was really bad, and I rewrote them. And they're not as good as the first ones I wrote. I know they're not. And but anyway, I am attempting to format this myself, so I am learning, and we'll see. If I don't do it, I'll have to pay to have somebody do it.
It just sounds overwhelming.
Yeah, well, you, one step at a time.
Okay. So, do you have anything else in mind when the Culver book is done?
No, but I'll find something.
I'm sure you will.
I like the idea of writing about people that lived in Decatur, because there's a lot of stories here. So I hope I could find another story. I don't want to step on anybody's pride or whatever, and that's hard to do when you're writing. I knew that Sarah Grady and William Grady did not have any children, and I knew there was no family around here. And I was surprised 2 years ago. Duane on Memorial Day said, "Let's drive by William's gravestone, just to see it." And I said, "Fine." And I say, I had researched his family thoroughly, so I knew there was nobody else around here, I thought. We went to the cemetery, got to the tombstone, and there was the biggest bouquet of flowers I had ever seen in my life. And I was upset. I thought, I missed somebody.
Somebody's here.
And so that was on a Sunday. On Monday, I went to Fairlawn Cemetery people and said, you know, who sent those flowers to William Grady? And they said, oh, well, we just get it from Horan's. And so I went to Horan's, and they said, ooh, who was this guy anyway? And he said, well, he sent them to himself. He has a trust at the bank, and that trust is, he died in 68, and that trust is still putting these flowers on his grave. But I was nervous because I really didn't want any family.
I guess you have.
Oh, dear. Right. So I hope I don't upset anybody, but if I could find another story, good story, about somebody in Decatur, I think I would do that.
Oh, so, I'll bet you could.
I'll look.
Oh, dear. One thing we haven't talked about was your family and what they do, and, like, do you have traditions? Do you always do something at specific times? And
the tradition is they come to my house on Christmas and Thanksgiving, and the meal has to be the same. And it's the same meal served Thanksgiving and the same meal served at Christmas time. You don't even vary the vegetables. It has to be exactly the same thing that we've done for years. And my house is over half full of family pieces. I say I'm an only child, only grandchild, so all of it came to me. And I love old pieces, so I've got them. I sit here in the living room, I look at my grandmother's music cabinet, my great-grandfather's liquor chest, my other side of my grandma's bookcase. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And it's a problem now, because we are going to try and downsize. And my sideboard, which has been to every holiday meal I can ever remember, it's always been there at my grandma's or at my house, but it's 5 feet long or wide and 9.5 feet tall, and my kids don't have room to put the side. I think they would like it, but nobody has room. Nobody has an old house that has high ceilings and so on. So don't know, but I have a lot of those pieces.
Moving out of here will be a real problem.
Yes, you will hear my exclamation for miles if somebody buys this house. Because I don't know what I'll do. I'm having my kids go around and make lists of things they want, but it's not going to, they're not going to take enough.
So, no.
So I don't know. And
now, lifestyles have changed drastically.
Yes, nobody really wants china. They certainly don't want my silver. You have to polish that. And, there's a few pieces, but no, basically not. That's one thing I do on our holiday meals. I always do the crystal and the china and the silver. They're complaining about that now, my kids, because they have to help do dishes, and most of that stuff can't go in the dishwasher. So, why don't you use paper plates? So, yeah. But no.
Yeah. Okay, so what have we not talked about that we would be interested in, or that you wanted to say?
Okay, well, things that influenced my childhood, maybe the things that were going on in the world. World War II was a biggie for me. I was 7 when it started and 11 when it ended. And that's one of the biggest events that looms in my childhood. And it affected me in so many ways, silly ways, but bubble gum was rationed, Hershey bars were rationed. I had my tinfoil ball. Every child that I knew would try to find gum wrappers or anything that had tinfoil on it, and then you'd make it into this ball. And when your ball got fairly big, then you'd take it down to somebody in the city, and they would give it to the war effort. So I always went around with my eyes to the ground trying to find tinfoil for my ball. I do remember on our small block on Park Avenue in Springfield, there were 4 gold stars, and the gold stars meant that they were dead and deceased. And being 8 or 9 years old, I didn't get the full impact, but I knew those people were never coming home again, Mr. Green and so on, you know. And so that was impactful. And I don't know. You'd go downtown and there'd be events. I can remember everybody standing around a circle in downtown Springfield and this person talking about trying to raise money for the savings bonds, I think, or something. And she pulled me up there and she said, "Do you sing God Bless America?" Because I was little, and I guess that was cute at the time to have me sing God Bless America. And it was daily. My shoes, I couldn't have, I only had 2 pair of shoes, and one was for Sunday church and one was for play. And then when one got, you had to throw one away, the Sunday shoes became the play shoes and so on. And of course, everything was rationed. I remember my mom giving away her sugar rations because she didn't cook that much sweet things, I guess. And she gave them to my aunt because she canned. When the war was over, my cousin who had been overseas in the war came to visit on his way home. He disembarked and he was on his way to Granite City, going home. And he stayed with us for a couple of days, and it was over the 4th of July. And he took me downtown Springfield on the 4th of July to a movie. And we came out of the movie theater, and somebody shot off 3 or 4 firecrackers. Next thing I knew, I was on the ground. He pushed me, and he came down on the ground, you know, just a reaction of hearing that noise. I have so many memories. My dad did not have to go because he was a mechanical engineer for Alice Chalmers, and they were building things for the war, and so he was in a job that, an important job for the war effort. And I don't know, that's the one thing I remember bad from my childhood. And so it did have an effect on me. I am very patriotic. And that's where it comes from. I mean, everybody was pulling in the same direction at that point in time. And Oh, and the man down the street was on Iwo Jima when they raised the flag. He was part of that group. That the picture that you always see. Yeah. And So yeah, it's very, very vivid still. The World War II memories. So. Yeah.
And then Korea would have been the next.
Right. And Duane was I guess he was in school, and you got deferred when you were in college, so he did not have to go to the Korean War. And then he was too old for Vietnam. So, yeah. So actually, my family fell in between the cracks for all the wars, so I don't have any military in my background. So, and my grandmother was the most patriotic woman I've ever known, and I think I spent tons of time with her, and I think that's where mine comes from. They were Germans, and in World War I, the Germans were not nice people.
No.
Yeah. Okay, and so she felt that very deeply, but she loved history, and she loved this country, and passed that on to me. And she was a DAR, and that was the biggest event in her life, was the DAR, and so, And I always go Memorial Day and do the flower thing in Springfield for the graves. And her DAR emblem was always kind of buried, so I always have to scrape the mud off of that because I know that would be very important to her. So. And we put a new stone on my great aunt's grave in my family's buried in Oak Ridge.
In Springfield.
Yes, in Springfield. And the first burial in Oak Ridge Cemetery was my great aunt. And she was 9 months old, and this was 1850, I guess. And her tombstone said, Liza Helmley died of teething at 9 months. And so, and that was gone. The stone was gone. So Dwayne and I just had it replaced. Because they have a sign on the road said, Liza Helmley, first burial in Oak Ridge. But there was nothing there. So we went ahead and put the stone back and with that inscription on it. So, so I enjoyed that. And, my folks are buried at Roselawn Cemetery, which is outside of Springfield, but still considered Springfield Cemetery. My grandpa started that, and his main thrust was not to have any headstones showing above ground. So it was just to be a grassy thing with all the things. And they have now decided that that's not going to work. I guess they weren't getting enough people that wanted that type of a burial, so now the headstones are appearing there. So, but he doesn't know that.
Oh, dear. Okay. Well, I want to thank you for doing this interview. And
you're so welcome.
We really appreciate it. This is June the 12th, 2018, and we're talking with Lynn Potter.
Right.
Thank you so
much. Well, thank you, Sally. I've enjoyed it.
Good.